It's The Wonky Show. This week, the bailout that's not a bailout. The new normal on campus. What does a socially distanced first term look like for learners? And governance. See, that gets going again or gets in the way. It's all coming up.
You know, the whole of the Higher Education Research Act was predicated on competition and choice. You know, that was the Joe Johnson mantra at the time. But, you know, if you read E6, it's basically saying, you know, please don't go out there and compete because we'll bang you on the head if you do. And I...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Jim Dickinson, and here to cheer us up with their optimism and foresight, as usual, we have two excellent guests. In Oxfordshire, serial non-exec director and general higher education big name, Mary Kernock-Cook. Mary, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, everyone. So my highlight was my dogs emerging from a scrutle in the woods and coming out, each of them brandishing a stinking, mouldering leg of deceased Muntjac. It was completely disgusting, but they looked so ridiculously pleased with themselves that it was definitely heartlifting.
Absolutely extraordinary. And in the Southwest, Greenwich's Director of Student and Academic Services, Chris Shelley, is here. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight, Jim, was installing a hot tub in the garden of my mother-in-law's house where we've relocated for lockdown. So I've now got somewhere to escape from either work or my children.
Excellent. So, yes, we start this week with the bailout that's not a bailout. On Monday morning, the government set out its package for support for higher education, and it's fair to say there was a level of disappointment. Mary, what's your take on the package?
So, well, here we go. A couple of weeks ago, Universities UK asked the government, I think, for about £2 billion worth of bailout. And last Sunday, the government didn't oblige. It did bring forward about 100 million of QR funding, and it reprofiled the tuition fee payments from the student loans company. And I think that brings forward about 2.5 billion of cash flow. But that was about it. No new money, just a bit of slightly different timing. But, and it's quite a big but, it also announced a temporary student number control and some new market smoothing measures. Now, the number control was at the level asked for by UUK, set at 5% over forecast, note forecast recruitment for UK and EU students. And then there was a sort of hat tipping towards the more recent million plus proposal to allocate up to 10,000 places, mainly for essential worker training such as nursing and midwives. So there's a couple of things to note here. One, that applicant demand across the sector, and this was measured pre-COVID, is up by, I think, only about 1.2%. I think most people think that's likely to fall as students are put off by the virus fallout. So in my book, capping at 5% above forecast is probably only going to curb recruitment at quite a small number of universities. And I think it won't do much to help those at the bottom of the pile who have suffered in any case since the student number controls were lifted in 2015. I think it's going to mean quite a few universities who simply cannot fulfil their financial obligations. And if you read Mark Corver's piece last week on Wonky, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the cap will only further depress weakening demand from students. I've also been heard to say that a cap on student numbers is a cap on ambition, but that only yeah. works if the cap is in any danger of being breached, and I'm not sure that it is. Now, if those concessions were supposed to be the carrot, watch out for the stick, and this comes in the form of a proposed new regulatory condition, E6, which Smita Jamdar, legal beagle supremo from Shakespeare Martineau, calls out for bringing broad, unspecific obligations which will create risks of unfairness and oppressive behaviour by regulators and could lead to legal challenges. I'm wondering whether it'll become higher education's Dangerous Dogs Act. If you're sorry about all the dog references this morning. Now, if you're feeling strong enough, do read the OFS consultation on this proposed new condition. Read it and I think probably weep. It's about as clear as mud how universities are supposed to try and maintain financial sustainability, condition D if you're listening at the back, when their every marketing or recruitment move might be judged contrary to the interests of stability and integrity in the sector. So while the OFS, through this so-called cap and the condition E6, is busy trying to stop the sector from giving students perhaps a wider choice of courses this year, it seems they're also supporting UCAS to enhance their clearing system, seemingly making it easier for students to make what I think could be rash decisions to self-release into clearing and then be matched through Clearing Plus or whatever it's called through data to a suitable course. I just think throwing a bunch of new variables into an already pretty precarious and unpredictable admission cycle feels a bit loaded with risk, but there we are. I just wish OFS had come at this more from the position of protecting current and prospective student interests. I think if we helped students feel really confident about starting or continuing their studies and what choices they were making, you know, that feels to me to be the place to start if you're wanting to protect the financial sustainability of universities. But a discuss, as they say.
Chris, what's your take on these traffic calming measures?
Well, I think it's reassuring that the government have turned to the sector finally and put something on the table. Obviously, it was not what we were hoping for. I think at least with the student number controls, for a lot of universities, as Mary says, we probably won't get near those kind of numbers. But at least it gives us some wiggle room and some scope for ambition, depending on what the market looks like by September. And of course, that is likely to be very volatile in between now and then. I mean, I think we're interested in the future. The working groups that have been formed as part of this will be very interesting, and I think especially around international recruitment and what the outcomes of that will be. And I think, it seems that the OFS have just taken this opportunity to give themselves a new set of teeth and perhaps give UCAS a new set of teeth as well. Which obviously will sort of remain to be seen how strong they are and how willing they are to bite down. And very intrigued by this this consultation on the new condition of registration and the language within that, broad and vague though it is, but sort of veiled threatening as well around the actions which could bring the sector into disrepute or whatever it is, which is very, very broad and also makes an interesting assumption that that universities might be about to leap out and start shouting about how badly other institutions are planning on dealing with this. And it's very clear that it is naughty to make claims about providers' quality of support or tuition when actually I think we're all still trying to work out what on earth we're all doing ourselves, let alone guessing what the university down the road is doing and whether or not it's good or bad or ugly and whether or not we would then, I don't know, put that in an email to an applicant. I'm not quite sure how that would play out, but it just seems that they've taken the opportunity, I think, to tell the sector that they're watching us and that they want us to behave. When actually, what we're all trying to do is do the best thing for applicants, for students, and for our own sustainability in the near future, really.
Yeah, I mean, the list of behaviours I think is extraordinary because it's really difficult to work out whether or not they are things that, you know, some people inside OFS have already seen or whether they're just sort of, you know, things that they think they might see in their wildest fantasies. So I think that's fascinating. But Mary, I mean, you've been close to the kind of applicant process right throughout your career. Well, what is it that students are supposed to do, you know, applicants are supposed to do right now in terms of weighing up different providers? Because, you know, as Chris says, it's actually difficult to work out what providers are going to be providing in September.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, my thinking would be that anything a university can do to reach out on a very personal basis, you know, literally phoning up one-to-one, discussing it with offer holders, is the kind of confidence that students will want and need, that somebody actually cares about them as an individual, as a person, and that they're not just part of a kind of herd of people wondering what the hell is going to happen in September. And I do think this idea, you know, I am slightly worried about this kind of UCAS Clearing Plus stuff, you know, not the offer itself to match students to places, which is great, but if actually this is an effort to get students to feel that they can change their mind at the last minute, when this is a year when they've had less opportunity. You know, a lot of them won't have been to open days. They won't have the opportunity to go to offer holders' open days, which would normally be taking place around now. And, you know, to kind of destabilize them by suddenly putting lots of new choice in front of them, I'm not sure is quite the best thing to do. So I think if I were in a university at the moment, I would be reaching out on a very, very personal level to every single applicant or offer holder.
Chris, back to this kind of big bailout question. Obviously, you know, lots of the critique of the package has been that it tends to, it treats the problem in the sector right now as a liquidity crisis rather than a a kind of solvency crisis. And what might happen if we end up with an actual solvency crisis?
Well, here's a phrase you might hear a lot now. It's becoming a new cliche in my head, which is we just don't know. And I think what we have to be doing is continuing to feed in via Universities UK and the mission groups what we're seeing, what are the trends on the ground, what are the numbers telling us about the students that may or may not be arriving in September and onwards? Because, like you say, this non-bailout is sort of predicated on the fact that everything will be normal in September to an extent. We're still going to have an awful lot of people applying and therefore paying tuition fees, and we're just going to make sure that you get that cash in your bank a little bit sooner. Well, actually, my colleagues in finance will be reassured by that to a certain extent because they're worried about cash in the bank. But actually, their biggest problem is the bottom line at the end of the financial year. So when that money comes in is less of an issue than is it coming in at all in the first place. And I think if the government at the moment feel that, on whatever basis it is, that students will still be turning up in sufficient enough numbers to keep everyone afloat, then if that isn't the case, and if we start to see the evidence that isn't the case, and we start to feel that, there's a real risk of institutions falling over because, applications have suddenly dropped by 50% on the same moment in last year's cycle, then we need to be making that clear so that they can respond appropriately. But at the moment, they do seem to think that things will be okay, and it's just about helping us through a short-term cash flow situation.
Well, they've also bought themselves some time, haven't they? They've allowed themselves to be able to wait until they see where the recruitment chips fall in August and September before deciding what to do next. So rather than anticipating what students might or might not do and who might or might not turn up or enrol or go into clearing, etc., they've put the short-term cash flow support in there. And, this will be revisited, won't it? As we watch the daily clearing data releases from UCAS in the middle of August, it'll start to become clear. And although we don't get provider level data at that stage, you can bet your life that UCAS will be providing that to government.
And of course, by then it may be too late to take any significant action. I mean, one of the things that concerns me is just the general tone. I mean, obviously we're in a market, and obviously institutions are competing against each other for students. But sometimes I worry that the language in these kind of statements from OFS it sort of undermines how well the sector works together. And I think the GISC mail bases have never been as alive as they are right now. But generally, we are a sector that does talk to each other. Clearly, marketing departments aren't going to share their tips and techniques. And fundamentally, when it comes down to it, we've all got our targets to hit and we all need to make sure that we can survive. But generally, as a sector, we talk to each other a lot. We do share our best practice. Wonki exists very much because we're all interested in learning what each other are doing. And while, yes, there is a competition within that market, I think we shouldn't be underplaying the fact that right now the sector is trying to respond to this together, and that actually, creating more divisions between us won't help us do that. Interested by sort of news coming out of New Zealand yesterday that implied that they're considering a University of New Zealand approach for the next 12 months to say, we've just got to come together as a nation, as a sector, and provide one single experience to recruit as many students as we can, make sure everyone survives, and then take it from there. And I think that's a very proactive approach to a problem. We're not going to be able to do that if we wait until August and suddenly the numbers start to crash.
I mean, Mary, Chris makes a good point, doesn't he? That we have a system, particularly in England, where the whole idea is that competition will cause an improvement in provision. Now, we could debate that until, the cows come home on a different podcast about whether in normal times competition of this sort generates improvement and quality. But I mean, it seems to me that it definitely doesn't right now.
I think that's right. And I think there's a real conundrum for the government and for the OFS, because, the whole of the Higher Education Research Act was predicated on competition and choice. That was the Joe Johnson mantra at the time. But if you read E6, it's basically saying, please don't go out there and compete, because we'll bang you on the head if you do. And I think this is very complicated. If the government really thought that competition meant just lots of nice universities offering nice courses that students would want to do and would support the economy and society and so on, but not make any effort to actually recruit people to those courses when their income is predicated on how many students they sign up, that was quite a naive view. Now, of course, we've got hopefully we've got a decade or so of growth in the size of the 18-year-old cohort, which will help a bit. But the idea that universities can't go out and communicate to students why they think their offer is a good one and why a student should want to come there is just, it's not realistic in a market.
And can I just ask you both, obviously we talk a lot about universities, but one of the things about the Higher Education and Research Act is that, you know, it was supposed to be, you know, the ushering in of this, you know, large number of alternative providers. And to be fair, there are, as of today, there are 394 providers on OFS's English register. And I guess, you know, the question about whether ministers would let a university fail is one thing, but whether or not ministers might let some of the, you know, the narrower end of that long tail fail is probably quite another.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, basically all of this is about the university sector. That's, you know, that's what I can't remember what the numbers are, but it's probably 90% of the sector is the 140 odd traditional universities. You know, so nobody's going to be overly bothered by some of the fallout at, you know, in the sort of long tail of small private providers. And that's not what's going to hit the headlines either. But a university falling over, and, you know, particularly in the new political post-December election landscape, you know, a lot of the, you know, what some people characterise as, you know, low quality courses, you know, offered in universities in the North and the Midlands, which were, you know, in those areas which fell from Labour to Conservative in the last general election. And I really don't know how that all squares with the kind of levelling up agenda, you know, not to mention the local economic fallout of a university going under.
Yeah, and I guess, look, Chris, we did get a couple of clues as to what might happen if and when this becomes a, you know, a solvency crisis. There was obviously a couple of lines in the package about, you know, a working group around research funding, and you'd have to guess that in the end that's the sort of money that would tumble into the kind of more elite end of the sector, and we've seen something similar in Scotland later in the week. And then there was this other line, wasn't there, about the you know, restructuring if all else fails. And, you know, certainly we've been looking at what's been happening over in FE over the past 3 or 4 years, and, you know, area reviews, you know, lots of sticks and carrots to try and get FE colleges to merge into groups. Do you think we might see something similar in, you know, in HE?
The thing is, we've asked this question before, haven't we? And there's been moments in the recent past where we thought, okay, you know, this is the government or the DfE or OFS or HEFCE or whatever's opportunity to start, you know, enforcing mergers or taking control or whatever. And I think it just comes back to that question of, you know, how strong are these new teeth that they're giving themselves, and how willing are they to use them? So that, yeah, they're hinting with that sort of language that those kind of steps might be taken. I mean, I still feel that they will want to make that a very, very last resort, and they will want to retain the autonomy of institutions, so to speak, as much as possible to get themselves out of whatever particular problems they are in. And if the whole sector is facing it, then that's a bit easier. If some individual institutions have made some bad decisions or have been particularly, you know, impacted badly because of the nature of their provision or their location or whatever it might be, they may need some specific help. I would just like to think we're still a few steps away from essentially government intervention and forced mergers and closures.
I don't know if you read the Financial Times today, you know, and we've got the Wolf of Downing Street, you know, Alison Wolf is in there. I think a few people might want to dust off the Augur report, which, Jim, you'll remind me, is it nearly 2 years old now?
No, it's almost, well I mean, of
course.
A
year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, it depends which milestone, because, of yeah. course, it was announced, and then we were going to get an interim yeah. report that never happened. I mean, it does feel like it's been going on since my early childhood. But
yeah, it does, doesn't it? But I think we've sort of allowed ourselves to let that kind of drift into the background, and it feels to me as if some of the, you know, conceiving of this as a tertiary education sector rather than just a higher education sector and a further education sector and an adult education sector, etc. it feels to me as if we probably need to reacquaint ourselves with those kind of arguments.
And again, you know, I thought Boris, you know, I don't know if you heard Boris in PMQs when, you know, his first appearance opposite Keir Starmer this week, but someone asked him a question about further and higher education, and his answer was really interesting, because, of course, he talks about universities in the context of kind of elite research and, you know, trying to work out what was happening with COVID, and he talked about the further education system and skills. And I guess, you know, the interesting question there will be what happens to the really big FE colleges that are doing lots of HE work, and what happens to, you know, the large number of, you know, post 92 universities that are doing lots of skills work? Because if that kind of simplistic bifurcation between universities and research and, you know, colleges and skills is what's in number 10's head, maybe, you know, some of those ideas in Augur are about to come back.
Yeah, and you know, and weep when you think what it'll do for diversification and access and widening participation. I don't know if anyone heard Lord Baker on the very late the midnight news on Radio 4 last night. He was suggesting that all arts and humanities courses should be online and only STEM courses should come back face to face in September. So there's an interesting thought.
Well, I mean, if as I have said on the site this morning, if you want to absolutely guarantee students feeling a deep sense of injustice, do go ahead and implement Lord Baker's proposal. Now, very good. Thanks. We'll come back to some of those. But for now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
So I'm Amite Doku. I'm a consultant at Naus Group. And prior to that, I was the Vice President of Higher Education at the National Union of Students. And I've written a piece reflecting 1 year on after the Closing the Gap report into the looking into the BME attainment gap and what the sector needs to do. And in my piece, I sketch out some of the key recommendations around having conversations about race and culture, developing racially inclusive environments, the recommendations around evidence and data and what works, and then really tried to talk a bit about what the implications are today, a year on, in a very different context with COVID-19, recognising that many colleagues who support this agenda will be concerned. They'll be concerned that existing BME students, their inequalities will grow as a result of digital poverty and other socioeconomic challenges. They're more likely to be disadvantaged to this current structure, but also that many initiatives will have been switched off. And I make the point very simply that actually, given that COVID-19 has driven coach and horses through business as usual, this is the time. An institution is much more receptive to change. And if you want to change the attainment gap, you have to make fundamental change. And given the changes that have happened over the last couple of months, this is probably the best time to strike.
And don't forget, we'd love to have your contribution on the site. If you'd like to pitch us a piece, do drop us an email at team@wonky.com with your idea and we'll be in touch. Now, next up, our recording day for this podcast is Thursday, and today, along with our friends at Aula, we're running an event on no buildings next term, as senior teams move some of the scenarios that have been worked up from wild ideas to concrete proposals. Chris, what does a socially distant September look like?
Well, unprecedented, sorry, we just don't know is the new unprecedented, but we're trying to work it out, we're trying to guess, and I think as the eyes of the nation turn to the Prime Minister on a Sunday evening to see what lockdown Mark II looks like, and to imagine what the immediate future looks like. The eyes of the sector for a few weeks now have been very much focused on September and trying to imagine how that applies to the teaching and learning experience and everything else around it for university campuses. You know, from a starting point, any kind of activity on campus in September, you know, will have to follow whatever government measures are in place at that time. And obviously, we're guessing at the moment what that might be. So, you know, very large groups of people, presumably at that point, will still not be allowed. But how do you define the difference between small, medium and large groups? Obviously, maintaining social distancing within teaching spaces, you know, between 1 and 2 metres apart, will significantly reduce capacities of those teaching rooms. So working up different models of the timetable based on smaller class sizes is a starting point. But you've got to pick a number. Are we talking 15% of your normal capacity, 20%, 25%? Actually, some teaching spaces will be different than others. You know, some that perhaps have got more than one entrance will be easier to socially distance students than others. If we are guessing that schools by then will be allowed back in, then you can assume that groups of up to 30 potentially are going to be allowed, because that's what class sizes are. So is that a number to go on the basis of? You know, we are having to guess, speculate, estimate and prepare for a whole range of different scenarios at the moment. So you know, just creating a timetable, it's worth saying that the process of creating a timetable is a complex, difficult and time consuming one at the best of times. So you know, my timetabling team are just about in the process of wrapping up the first draft of the timetable for what would, invert commas, normally be in place in September. And actually now we've been asked to create one based on Model A, Model B and Model C as well. And who knows if Models A, B and C will even be what comes out of it. So there's a huge amount of work going on in the background to try and model what these scenarios look like. And of course, within this, we've got to try and deliver a, you know, high quality but equitable experience from the teaching point of view. So if students can come onto campus, then should they be able to? And we'd obviously want to facilitate that where possible. But the students that either can't come onto campus because we aren't letting them, because we're minimising the lessons that will actually be taught on campus, or maybe their international students haven't yet been able to fly into the country, or perhaps they are having to socially isolate themselves still because they're living with vulnerable family members or even ill themselves, then they've got to be able to get the same experience as much as possible, at least the same sort of teaching outcomes as those that are in the classroom. So, you know, we're looking at flipped classroom models where the time spent together is much more discussion-based and digesting teaching rather than just sort of taking in information. Obviously, we're also looking at how the timetable might be spread out over the day, and we're talking potentially about you know, more evening classes, and that obviously has an impact on staff time, but also might be more acceptable for then students who are more remote. So there are so many different elements of this to consider, not least the fact, of course, that what happens in weeks 1, 2, and 3 of the term might be different to what happens in weeks 4, 5, and 6 of the term if a second phase of lockdown comes in, or the measures change in whatever way they do. So institutions like ourselves all around the country will right now be modelling different scenarios with the aim that what we come up with is something that can be flexible and applied to, you know, multiple scenarios, but ultimately is still delivering a quality and equitable experience. And what that also then translates to is the bits around the teaching. So all of the professional services and all of the other activities that would take place on campus that are currently obviously being delivered remotely. And actually, I think some of that will be retained, actually, even well past the COVID crisis. We've learned an awful lot about how we can do things differently, and some of our services will continue to be delivered remotely. Students should be able to access appointments online if they need it. We should be doing online virtual workshops to teach students around, you know, how to apply for post-study work visas or whatever, the sorts of things that we're doing right now. But also, what I find interesting is we've grappled as a sector for a long time with this: how do we reach this mythical group of students that we call commuters? These people that don't live on our campuses all the time and aren't automatically engaging with us on a face-to-face basis daily. Well, suddenly everyone's a commuter student. So the way that we're reaching out to our students right now can actually teach us some really valuable lessons for the future. So some of the things we've been doing, for example, working with our students' union, you know, calling every student in residences directly to check on their well-being, you know, turning some of our services into sort of virtual events, you know, creating virtual events, running them in the evening, putting a whole range of social activities and programs on, whether it's sort of fun things like games and, you know, Netflix parties or whatever, but also things like language learning and you know, just additional skills that we can deliver in a remote sense that still brings students together in that virtual way. Well, actually, we should be retaining this, and I think that we will be, and what the whole student experience looks like after this, let alone after September or in September, will be quite significantly different. But, you know, ultimately we are having to model based on the guidance that comes out from the government, and I guess the first hint as to what that looks like will come on Sunday, but the advice will change so much between now and September that our ultimate aim is to be as ready and prepared and as flexible as possible to deliver an experience from September, which the government clearly, as we've said, are expecting us to be up and running at that moment in time.
Mary, obviously there's a huge pressure at this point on universities to announce something, not least because, you know, lots of universities in North America are saying they will be open to enrol. And I guess, you know, that international competition thing is putting lots of pressure on universities to announce. But there's a danger here, isn't there, that universities announce something when, you know, they're still in the process of working out what's possible and what isn't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people talk about the new normal. I think it's the new abnormal, the new turbulence. And I'd like to think that there's some silver linings for students, you know, if they find that actually the new unit post-COVID or COVID university experience means an abundance of small group teaching, for example. I think that's probably a good thing if they have their lectures delivered through platforms and apps and then consolidated in smaller groups. And the other thing I've reflected is that you know, students and universities are very resourceful. That's, you know, that's one of the things I think, has sort of surprised everybody in all of this, is that this unprecedented situation. You know, people have just adapted to it, haven't they, really quickly? And I think that students will very quickly work out ways for themselves to keep themselves safe and within their kind of comfort zone in a potentially somewhat socially distanced campus. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, talk of a January start instead of a September start seems to have faded out. And I think that's a good thing, because I think it would be tremendously disruptive to have, you know, one cohort going through on a different timetable to everyone else. I think it comes back to, you know, telling students what you're doing. I think, you know, if students were getting the kind of communication we've just heard from Chris about what you're planning for, so that they know you are at least thinking about all of these different scenarios, I think that would be tremendously comforting and would be a big confidence boost to them. I think there's real problems around accommodation. Really, really worry about, how universities and students can manage to make sure they've got accommodation when and if they're allowed to use it. And that those who are, who are not renting direct from the university itself, you know, how on earth we can provide protections for them so that students aren't having to live somewhere and pay rent for somewhere where they're not living. So, you know, there are multiple complexities to this situation. But I think young people are very, very resourceful. And if we can keep them on side, you know, to know that they're going to be looked after, whatever turns out to be the reality, I think they might even quite enjoy being part of a, you know, quite an experimental term start this year. And of course, universities are also going to have to be planning for whether there are future waves of lockdown and so on. So it is going to be very, very different.
But let me ask you both this question. So obviously, to some extent, there's been, and I understand why, because it's the core thing that universities are providing. There's been lots of focus on, you know, the kind of contact time, the teaching bit, the, you know, the seminars, the lectures, the labs and so on. But, you know, for the 120 other hours a week that a student is awake and moving and so on, if commuter students can't get on public transport and residential students have got to go back to their tiny room alone, this isn't a viable student experience, is it?
That's why I made the point about students being resourceful, and I think they would find ways of meeting, communicating within whatever the current rules of the situation are. I've just observed, you know, my own. I've got two grown up kids locked down with me here at home. And it's astonishing how cheerfully they've just, you know, kind of upturned their lives and readapted. I have great faith in young people to figure out ways to make the best of things.
Good stuff. Now, from designer PPE to improbably socially distanced lecture theatres, the new normal for university life is going to look like a strange and unusual place in a few months' time. But how will it work, and how on earth will we get there safely? Kicking off our new series of events called Wonky at Home, I'm going to cut through all the background noise and big political debates to take you on a tour of the unique challenges ahead facing university leaders, students and the whole university community. Wonky at Home, the new normal, what will it look like and how will universities get there, is our exciting online event. Full details are available on wonky.com/events. I'm going to take you on that tour, and in response we'll debate all of the ideas with an expert panel hosted by Wonky's editor-in-chief Mark Leach and Mary Stewart, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, and some other speakers. All to come. Who should come? Leaders, managers, heads of department, comms, planning, estates, IT, everything in between. Academics wondering what on earth your university will look like later this year, and indeed anyone interested in how universities will need to change in the months and years ahead. 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Friday the 15th of May at wonky.com/events. See you at home. Now, governance. It's probably fair to say that in the initial emergency period, governance got out of the way and allowed senior teams to crack on with crisis management. But there are big decisions about the future looming, and so governance is probably about to kick back in. Mary, you're a serial non-exec. What are some of the things governors ought to be thinking about?
Well, I mean, you're right, Jim. It's been a very challenging time for governing bodies, both to support the executive in the eye of the storm and then, you know, at the right time, lifting their eyes above the horizon and planning for a future of, I think, more unknowns, unknown unknowns than we could possibly know. But from both sides of the boardroom table, executive and non-executive, I've always found it really interesting to observe how the risk registers stand up to the reality of a big hairy risk crystallizing. and I found that, you know, there's rarely a risk register that's shown to have actually anticipated what then transpired. I'm pretty sure that not many universities had actually planned for a pandemic and lockdown scenarios. But I think it's worth saying that universities who had the known unknowns well managed, you know, all the stuff that we do, cybersecurity, IT resilience, communication cascades, financial stuff, contract failure, quality, and so on, the ones who were doing that really well will have found that they had more headspace to handle the very specific fallout of the coronavirus crisis because their basic risk housekeeping was in good shape. I think, and as we touched on earlier, I think it seems inevitable that a restructuring of the higher education sector is in the sights of government, you know, accelerated and focused by this existential financial crisis that many universities will be facing. I mentioned the Financial Times piece this morning, which is worth reading, and the kind of non-bailout underlined this. So governments move to shore up short-term cash flow, and I think it'll then look at the financial and structural fallout when the autumn recruitment picture gets clearer. And that gives it time to see which universities can be strong-armed into new arrangements. The narrative's been there for a long time now. Low quality courses, excessive debt, high salaries, too many graduates in non-graduate jobs. And there's still, you know, a big handful of old school Tories who think that too many people go to university. And as I mentioned, we've got Alison Wolfe, who was part of the Augur Review, advising at the heart of government in the Prime Minister's office. So I think governing bodies will need to be on the front foot. They'll be needing to urge their hard-pressed leadership teams to find time to think strategically about the future. And they'll need some imaginative and carefully positioned responses if they're to avoid being, you know, done to it by the government. I think shocks like this can have a silver lining. They provide a new backdrop and a real kind of urgency for some zero-based strategic planning where all the old norms get thrown out of the window. So I think governing bodies need to start reimagining what higher education in the 2020s and beyond could look like, and they'll need to do it really quickly. I think they've got to have something to put on the policy table so that the government doesn't eat higher education as we know it for breakfast.
And this is a really interesting question, isn't it, Chris? Because on the one hand, you could probably make a case for governing bodies, probably which contain lots and lots of members that are really busy with their own organisations or, you know, careers or whatever, kind of stepping back and letting managers try and get through the, you know, the extended crisis. You can make another case that says, hold on, governing bodies need to step up, step in, you know, and take charge of these big strategic questions about, you know, either expenditure reduction or you know, where the university goes next.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, it's the usual question of where do you want to be in 10 years' time actually now needs to be broken down probably into, you know, asking ourselves what does the sector, but also our university look like in 2 years and 3 years and 5 years and 10 years, and where is it we want to get to, but how are we going to you know, change shape and look different and get to where we need to be in what could be a quite rapidly changing, especially for this sector, you know, look and feel and structure. And I think those, you're absolutely right, you know, governing bodies need to be asking those questions and driving those questions. I mean, I think we're very lucky at the University of Greenwich. Our governing body is has always been, I think, quite strategic in its thinking and its planning and its probing. And we've just had a new vice chancellor start just before Christmas. So we're already asking ourselves some of those fundamental questions. But, you know, immediately that's been obviously slightly refocused. And actually imagining what the university looks like in 10 years' time is impossible without imagining what it looks like in 2 years.
Mary, is the sector's governance fit for purpose for the sort of, you know, the size and shape of the crisis that might be coming?
I think one of the problems is that strategic planning takes an absolute age in universities, more so than in any other organisations that I've ever been involved with, because of the sort of democratic governance, internal governance structures that are there. So, you know, I find myself getting involved in university governance that sort of, I've called it before, the schizophrenia between professional services and academics is just such a real pity, because I feel like both sides of the organization are actually trying to do the same thing and both need each other. I was, you know, I was really struck. I tweeted an article from the Telegraph yesterday about students wanting rebates of fees, which I think is an entirely reasonable position. And there was a kind of a stream of responses to it. On the one hand, parents and students saying, hey, you know, we're not getting everything we paid for. It would be really nice if somebody recognized that. And on the other hand, a load of academics saying, we're working really hard, we're not shut, you know, this is, we, you know, I'm working till 10:30 at night, et cetera, et cetera. And both are right. But for me, it really, it really kind of put the spotlight on this kind of divide between a reality between the professional services and the academic side. And I think if, you know, sometimes you need a good crisis to crystallize things, and certainly governing bodies need to move quickly to rethink what they're going to be like and to rethink how they can strategically position themselves in something that's conceived of as a more collaborative tertiary sector, a more coherent tertiary sector. And, you know, they can't take 2 years to do that and go through all the committee structures and so on. So I hope that universities will feel that they can alter their approach to strategic planning, and that they can find ways of bringing all sides of the university on board with that, but not in the way that it's traditionally done.
It's a bank holiday weekend, so I think we should try to identify something that is potentially, you know, it's a bit of optimism for the weekend. So mine is, and I've been saying this to a few people this week, I've got a feeling that in 5.5-6 months' time, even if we still by then haven't got a vaccine or haven't got, you know, effective treatments and so on, that we may well have a much more sophisticated way of slowing or halting the transmission of COVID-19 than ham-fisted social distancing. You know, it might be civilian-style PPE or something. But the science in 5.5 months' time may well have found a way to enable us to get on public transport and live and work together in a way that we can't perceive of right now, because it's still May. And so my bit of optimism is, I think, you know, there is at least a scenario where lots of this might be all right in 5 or 6 months. Chris and Mary, your piece of optimism.
I agree with you, Jim. I was judging a kind of an innovation in EdTech thing a few months back, and I think, I can't remember if it won or was in the highly commended, but was a pandemic simulation, which sounds exactly like what they're doing in the Isle of Wight. And it was Bluetooth enabled, and students could, you know, they got allocated whether they were infected or not, and whether they had face masks and vaccines and things or not. And then they were able to game it by, you know, by Bluetooth connections to other people who had the app on their phone. So, yeah, I'm also optimistic. And, you know, and I just come back to this idea that I just think the whole country has been so extraordinary, the way that it's adapted to, you know, a massive, massive change in how we all live and work or don't work, how we live our lives. And undoubtedly, people are finding good things from all of this. You know, I'm certainly very cheerful about not having to get on a train into London 3 or 4 times a week. And actually, I find some of the meetings that I do online are very fruitful, and sometimes they feel a bit more democratic than when you've got human beings, you know, in a physical room together. I think this sort of rush to online is going to be really interesting. I think it'll be wonderful to see people get really good at using platforms and apps for learning. You know, I keep thinking, you know, young people, they listen to podcasts all the time. They use WhatsApps. They don't think of that as, you know, online communication. It's just communication. And I think if we could get to a place where it's just learning, and if it's mediated through through a different platform or a different app, and we get really good at that, then it just opens up so many possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I just look to the future optimistically, just because of how well and how quickly we've adapted and responded so far. I mean, you know, I sit on many groups that meet monthly, and in the last couple of weeks we've gone, crikey, didn't the world feel different the last time we met? And you know, how much has changed in 4 weeks? And obviously now we're sort of, you know, into week six and week seven. As you say, we're 4 months away from the start of term, so an awful lot will change in that time. But for a sector that is notoriously slow at changing itself, and universities are notoriously slow at changing ourselves while we're great at changing the world, we've suddenly learned how to change things quickly. And it's really been inspirational to see how you know, colleagues have done that, and you know, my learning and teaching colleagues almost literally overnight preparing teaching and assessment to be delivered in a completely different way, and everyone gets behind it, everyone gets on board with it, and suddenly it's there and it's available, and we're all working together to the same goal. And you know, if the goalposts move again, whether it's this Sunday or 3 Sundays later or 2 months time, then I'm very assured that we will be able to react, we'll be better prepared because we'll have had more warning. But actually, when we need to move quickly, we do.
So that's about it for this week. To find out more about anything we've discussed today, you'll find links on the episode page at wonky.com, where you can also leave your thoughts and comments. Don't forget, you can subscribe to us automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show on your favourite podcast directory, or you'll find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you think you've got what it takes to be a guest on the show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. Thanks again to our guests, Mary and Chris, to everyone at Team Wonky for making the show happen, and of course to you for listening. Until next week, stay wonky.